CliffCentral.com.
Aubrey Molden has written a book. It's something of an autobiography. It's really, really interesting, and I think you should take a look at this. It's very, very cool. He's coming in to say hello to us now, and Flax has just gone to fetch it. We'll find out all about the book. We'll find out all about what he's been doing. He's been in the advertising business for much time and has some interesting stories to tell us. He's worked with some really cool and interesting people, too. And we will find out all about Aubrey. Aubrey Molden, our guest for the morning. Let's give him the proper Cliff Central hello for today and see what he has to tell us. Good morning, sir. How are you, Aubrey? Nice to meet you. Let me switch on this microphone and get everything working properly. It's a pleasure to have you here. Privilege to have you here. Good to see. I managed to read through a lot of your book over the weekend. And congratulations. What an interesting life you've led. Huh?
I think so, yeah.
I think so.
The advertising life is one of those where you can be working at 5 in the morning until 5 in the morning the next morning. So there's a lot of things that happen. There's a lot of pressure on you all the time. But it's also one of those professions that I think that if you work your balls off like that, you're going to have some fun along the way. So that's really what the stories are about. A lot of fun that happened to me, a lot of serious things that happened to me, and just enjoying those long hours, basically.
Well, let's go right back to the beginning, because we could go into, you know, where you come from and all the rest of it, but I think for a lot of people what might be really interesting is that you actually worked with some of the great gurus of advertising. David Ogilvy, who's the guy who started Ogilvy and all its subsequent transformations into various agencies, and became Ogilvy Mather, it became Ogilvy this, that, and the other, but he was always the guy at the beginning.
Yes.
Of all of these stories.
Yep.
Now, what kind of a guy was this, and how did you meet him?
Well, David was my big boss. I was working, fortunately or unfortunately, in the Brussels office, which was only just down the road from David's chateau in Tuffeau, where he was the big, big boss. And David was known as the Holy Spook. And the reason why he was the Holy Spook, although he had 69 offices, he had his finger in every single pie. And he was a bit of a tyrant, actually. There was one rule within Ogilvy and Mather, and that was David was always right. He was a very, very awkward person to work with. If you believed in all his rules all the time, and you stuck to those rules all the time, and you played the game all the time, mm-hmm. then he'd love you to bits. And I was immature enough not to always play by the rules. And I got into a lot of trouble with David ultimately. Ultimately, he fired me.
So you say he was a difficult guy to work with, and he was awkward to be around, and he was a bit of a tyrant. But he must have been, there must have been something special about him. Was it just his work ethic? Was it the fact that he was a bit of a slave driver? Or was it because he could see advertising in ways that other people couldn't? I mean, was he a visionary of a kind?
He was a visionary. He had rules, and the rules were based on very, very hard facts. And a lot of the rules, even if you read his old books today, they make utter sense. I mean, he was the first person, really, to put science and art into advertising. And if you were to follow his rules, I don't think you could go wrong in the work that you were producing. But not necessarily would you ever produce brilliant work, but you'd always produce work that worked. And he produced a whole load of things called magic lanterns, which were really sort of inductions for everybody on this is how food advertising works, this is how motor car advertising works, this is how charity advertising works, this is how you lay out advertisements, this is how you do radio commercials. And he was very, very right in what he said. The issues were, as he got older, towards his 70s, he began to lose focus and understanding of how the market was changing.
I'm amazed by the kinds of stories and the sort of people you had as clients, or the sort of people you've had to work with, because some of them weren't clients, but you ended up having to do things with them, whether they were people you hired for a commercial shoot or whether they were people who you had to make look good. There are a bunch of interesting stories. You met, I mean, the Queen and Prince Charles, among others. Tell us about some of those stories, because I think people would like to know what they're like from the point of view of you as someone who they don't necessarily want around all the time.
Well, first of all, when we started working for Prince Charles and therefore the Queen, Prince Charles then had something called the Prince's Trust, the Queen's Royal Jubilee Trust, and the King George Trust. It was three trusts, basically, that were brought together with a great vision from Prince Charles, which was recognizing that there was a lot of poverty in the UK, particularly the 16 to 25-year-old groups, and couldn't get a leg up in profession or any way of working, is that he, totally free gratis, would give people money. He'd give it away so that they could, for example, if they wanted to be a drummer in a band, he would just give them money to go and buy a set of drums.
I've heard very good things about the Prince's Trust. I've heard that they've helped huge numbers of people, but they've more especially helped them to do the things they really want to do.
That's right. The money was an injection to give them a leg up. The beautiful thing about it was that his team would interview the individuals. They'd make a decision on the loan, and they'd give... No, sorry, it wasn't a loan. That's totally incorrect. They'd give them the money. That was it. And they would never ask them to report back. They just let them go and sail off, and if they made it, they made it. And when we first started working for them, there were the three trusts. And our job was to actually somehow give this a brand, because it really wasn't a brand. And we were consulted by him, and we advised him to take away the Queen's Royal Jubilee Trust and the King George's the Trust, and then just call it the Prince's Trust, to which the Queen objected to. And as Tom Shabir, who was in charge of the Trust, actually said to us, said, the Queen, she is not amused. And from there, really, the thing took off. They had about 1,000 people that they were giving money away to. Now they're giving money away to 56,000 people. They've got a staff now of 1,000. They've got 6,000 volunteers that actually work for them. We instigated rock concerts for them where Phil Collins played, where Kate Bush played, where Madness played and so forth. Got extra income, extra exposure for them. And I think one of the biggest hurdles that we had to overcome for them, because I think as we all understand, with very famous people, there's a lot of sycophants around them. And that was also true of Prince Charles. And he recognized that. But when we wanted to go out and communicate with the youth, our job was to make sure that the youth understood that a rich man like Prince Charles was willing to give money away. Because the thing that they were afraid of is how could a rich git like Prince Charles possibly give me, this poor fellow, £400 for a sewing machine or for a set of drums? So we went out and we photographed a whole load of people that had been given money by Prince Charles, including this kid that we saw. And if you stripped him down, he had tattoos all over his body, a magnificent set of tattoos.
Yeah.
And he was this sort of like wiry character. He looked like a boxer and he swore like a boxer.
Yeah.
And he was rough as a bear's ass. And this guy, you know, we interviewed him about how he got the money, and we put together a case history. We featured him on a poster, and we presented it to the committee at the Prince's Trust. And one of the ladies there said, "Oh, good God, we couldn't possibly show him. He looks terrible. And also, we actually couldn't possibly condone the use of tattoos like that." And he did. He had more tattoos than the All Blacks put together. I mean, it was a magnificent show of tattoos. And we had to fight to get this poster shown, because this woman just wouldn't want it associated with the Prince's Trust, whereas Prince Charles would want it associated with the Prince's Trust.
Did he eventually come to your aid and say, "Yeah, I do want it"?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think one of the biggest problems we often came across with these sycophants, these brown noses, if you like, that actually double-guessed Prince Charles.
Yeah.
And Prince Charles was a very, very down-to-earth
person. You sat in meetings
with
him, though?
Yes. Yeah.
And what was he like? Very personable, very friendly?
Very straightforward. Very straightforward. And like, as I say, like a lot of people, another person we worked with was Sir Jackie Stewart, the ex Formula One racing driver.
Right.
Same issues there. A lot of sycophants, but Jackie was just a lovely person to work with. Strategically, very open-minded, and you'd always turn around at the end of the meeting and say, "You are the experts. If that is your opinion, we will go with your opinion."
Wow. That is such a tough thing to find in advertising these days, because everybody thinks they know better. Advertising is one of those businesses where I think a lot of people appoint themselves experts. They don't necessarily have the experience you have. They don't necessarily have the ideas that people who are paid to come up with those ideas all day have. You have a marketing manager who's appointed just because there was a gap in the company. And that marketing manager comes into a pitch, looks at a great idea, and goes, "Oh, no, I'd rather do it this way."
Yeah.
And everybody goes with it because they're the marketing manager.
Yeah, the problem is in the advertising industry today is that there are not a lot of trained advertising professionals. You know, I've worked and trained with people from Harvard and Drake and Cambridge and Oxford and so forth, some really, really bright people. I'm not saying that there aren't really bright people around these days, but it is no longer that profession that people really say, "I'm going to go into advertising and it is a profession and I'm going to be a trained professional. The problem that you have now is a lot of people, when they look at work, the creative work that you're actually showing to them, they don't put themselves in the place of the target audience. And what they do say when they judge the work, they say, "I don't like it. Quite frankly, I don't care if they don't like it, because they're not the target audience." It's down to the target audience. And how can you? Like David did with the work that we were doing with Paul McCartney. David Ogilvy turned around and he said, "I don't want Paul McCartney advertising the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund." He said, "You don't advertise a serious organization like you advertise chewing gum with a rock star." And David was totally wrong. He was 70 years old. McCartney was about 40 years old at the time. McCartney supported looking after animals. He had a farm in Scotland. He used to wear no leather. He had all the reasons for supporting and being relevant to the World Wildlife Fund. Yet David actually said, "I'm not having it." And David was absolutely wrong. And the same sycophantic thing happened to me, is that I phoned up everybody within Ogilvy's, everybody within the WWF for their support. And they turned around to me and they said, "Aubrey, you know, you're absolutely right." So I said, "Can I expect your support then when I go up against David?" And every single one of them said,
"No."
No. Exactly.
Is that what you got fired over?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Paul McCartney knew you were going to use him?
No, what was interesting there is a lesson. Here's a lesson for everybody. Don't go through an agent, okay, because you never get to the person. We actually got through to Paul McCartney's chauffeur. And Paul McCartney's chauffeur was having a word with Paul, and Linda McCartney was in the back of the car. And then I got this phone call from our contact and said, "Guess what, Aubrey, we've managed to get McCartney." And I said, "Absolutely brilliant, well done." And then there was a pause at the other end, and the
said
person
Linda
said,
McCartney. Said,
"The wrong McCartney, Linda McCartney."
Wow.
And I then made the mistake, often one does make mistakes, and I said, "Well, we don't want Linda, we want Paul." Really what I should have said is, "Yeah, Linda will do," because of course she was part of Wings.
Right.
And so Paul would have done it. So, you know, we had everything lined up, and David just stopped it like that.
You got fired.
Yeah.
What's it like to be fired from a massive media business like that, an advertising giant like Ogilvy & Mather, and then to go out and have to do your own thing?
Well, at that time, I think it really was, it was very tearful, you know, particularly because I believed in what we were doing with McCartney, and to be flogged by David, and he does flog you, I mean, he really does, he goes after you, it really, really did upset me for many, many years, but now I wear it as a badge of honour. I think it was great to be fired by him because I had principles. I stuck by those principles. And the interesting thing is ultimately what happened is Ogilvy's as an organization said to me, "We don't want to lose you, but there's a job going in South Africa." David hates South Africa. He hates apartheid. He's going to come nowhere near you. Why don't you go and have a look at South Africa?
And it brought you here.
That's how I arrived here. Met my wife here. Have a fabulous life. Met you here.
Now, in South Africa, what are the differences between when you came here then and the South Africa you're in now in terms of advertising? I'd imagine there must be a huge lens through which you can look back on how so much has changed in South African advertising. I mean, it must have seemed almost a little rudimentary then by comparison with what it is now.
There was a lot of clever advertising here when I arrived, and there was a lot of rubbish. There's no doubt there was a lot of rubbish. What has happened is a lot of the international agencies have arrived here now, and they've begun to screw things up because of the way that the accountants have got involved and high pressure on people to turn advertisements around quickly. And make large profits. Like, you've now got Sir Martin Sorrell, for example, that owns practically every single advertising agency that exists, including JWT and Ogilvy's, for example.
Mm-hmm.
In the early days when I was here, most whiteys wouldn't go into Soweto. They were terrified of going into Soweto. I used to go into Soweto with SAB. And we opened our eyes, the eyes of a lot of our clients, to actually the future market, which was obviously, unfortunately, that term that we still use here, which is the black market, which I hate as a term.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in those days, there were very, very few real brands. I think the major difference that we found when I came back is that people are brand crazy in this country. You know, if you think, years and years ago, there were probably about four or five basic manufacturers of motor cars in this country. Now there's 20 or 30. There's over 2012 models to choose from. In those days, there were about 50 models to choose from. So the world's your oyster. Nike weren't here before. You know, Reebok weren't here before.
Do you think the choice and options to that degree almost limit the ability for any single brand to punch through the noise?
No, I think they're capable of doing that. The problem is if you haven't got the balls to do it, you don't do it. So a lot of the multinationals sort of like stick by the rules, and they don't do things differently. And it is when you do different things differently that you do punch through. I mean, if you look at the way that Apple worldwide have built themselves into a brand, they did it in a very, very different way to people like HP, for example. If you read about how Steve Jobs did it, he did it in a very, very different way. We have international clients and we have local clients. And our local clients get afraid of the international clients. And what we say to them is, be assured that you can do a better job than those international clients, because the international clients are sluggish and they take ages to change direction. As a local client, you can be fleet of foot, you can be faster, you can make faster and better decisions, you don't have to go back to head office in New York and ask for approval, and you can get on with it. So you can build local brands quickly if you've got the balls to do it.
Do you think make a difference in the world of social media and the world of increasing interconnectedness, where everybody is just a click of a button away? Do you think it's much harder to get into people's frame of reference? There's so much information. We're being delivered a barrage of marketing messages every single day. Do you think that has made advertising better or worse? Because some people would argue you don't have anybody's attention for long enough to be able to do something really brilliant. But other people would say, well, if you've only got their attention for a second, you have to be that much more brilliant to deliver a message in that amount of time.
Yeah. So,
is it the former or the latter for you?
For me, it's the both. And that's what makes it interesting. First of all, from a media point of view, is that you have got all those tools that are useful, where you can reach people. But the speed that people do things in now, and I'm talking about creating and understanding and putting together a strategy, not enough attention is paid to putting together the strategy in the first place and understanding the target audience. there is some very interesting research in this country which is available to every single company in this country, mm-hmm. which is not properly used. People race ahead and they immediately say, oh, it's social media, or it must be TV, or it must be radio. They don't do their homework first. And the beauty that I've found is, since we've had our little company, is we can spend more time thinking than doing. And most of the competitors spend time doing. They race into social media.
And they've got deadlines, and they're being pressured to do things much quicker than they would like to, so they deliver a rubbish product.
Yeah, quickly, on time, on budget, that's it. Now let's move on to the next thing. But if you really do hone your thinking and get the thinking right, and then put your balls on the line and go in that direction, you can make a huge difference. And we've done it with tiny, tiny clients.
What is the business called?
It's called the Forensic Marketing Company.
Right. And you started that back in what?
About 10 years ago.
Gee.
When I left Ogilvy's.
And obviously it's gone tremendously well. I mean,
yeah.
You must be very happy.
Yeah.
And your book, which is called Between the Briefs, obviously... Yes. You mean advertising briefs, but there's a nice tongue-in-cheek double entendre there.
Yep.
Your cover of your book has got a pair of jeans that are sort of zipped.
Yep.
Or half unzipped.
Yes. Or half done up.
Right. But briefs and advertising are an interesting thing, because you sometimes get a very narrow definition of what is required. And sometimes it makes it very difficult to deliver anything but exactly what that client wants. And maybe what they want is just, you're okay on something. Because maybe they just need to run this by you to make sure that it's a good idea. But often those very narrow briefs can be prohibitive. They stop you from being creative in some ways. And then you get people who just say to you, just come up with something. And they don't give you any pointers at all. They don't give you a brief. They say, just do what you do. That's why you're in advertising, and that's why I pay you to do my advertising. Which do you prefer as the client?
We prefer what we call the freedom of a tightly defined brief.
Uh-oh, so you want both again.
We run workshops for clients too. And the first thing that we actually talk about is what the value of a brief is. For us, the value of the brief is it's the reconnaissance that you do, the thinking that you do before you start creating. So a brief has got to have objective thinking in it again, so that when you measure whatever that work is and you decide if you're going to run it, you don't say, do I like it? What happens is you go back to the brief and saying, what are we trying to achieve? How are we trying to achieve it? Who are we trying to do it to? Is this work likely to do that or not? If you do not have that written down or thought through, you have nothing to evaluate your work against, and you have no reconnaissance. It's like we use as an example the battle at Spionkop during mm-hmm. the Boer War, and we show people pictures of actually what happened, is that the Brits, being very clever Brits, went up the hill the night before, and they drew a map of how they were going to get up the hill, where they were going to hide, and then when they got to the top, how they were going to shoot all the Boers. But the reconnaissance wasn't right, because they went up the hill, they got up to the hill, they shot a few Boers, and then the mist lifted, and then suddenly there was another hill above the Brits, okay. with the Boers looking down upon them, and they shot them all. So they didn't do their reconnaissance. So we will sit and we will write a brief with a client, which is about a page of A4, no more than that. Very simple. Agreed, this is your target audience. This is what we think they think. This is what we want them to think. This is what we want them to do. And therefore, the creative work is going to be judged against that. And the medium is going to be selected against that too. So that's the homework. That has to be done. Otherwise, you're wasting your money. Otherwise, you're going to be shot by the Boers.
Now, you were saying that a lot of these famous people that you've dealt with have sycophants around them who tell them how wonderful they are.
Yep.
But there are some of them that are actually nice people. I mean, the principals themselves, these famous people. Who have you worked with that was really pleasant, easy to do things for, they made your life simple and there was no complication? Are there people like that we would know?
Well, certainly Sir Jackie Stewart was absolutely like that. I mean, he was... first of all, he was one of the wealthiest men in the world, one of the businessmen in the world, sat on the board of Rolex, sat on the board of Moët Chandon, sat on the board of Ford, was a good friend of the Queen, Prince Philip, and so forth, and hectically busy. And all I can do is contrast him with the head of one of the world's biggest brewers that we also worked with. Wherever Sir Jackie was, if you were doing work for him, wherever he was, he would get on the phone within 4 hours and actually reply to your communication, wherever he was in
the world.
This
was in a time before email and before it was easy for someone to just get on the phone.
Before and during, yeah.
Right.
And then you take the chairman of the brewery, for example, is that he wouldn't even answer your calls. So huge, huge difference between someone who is rich and wealthy and a real entrepreneur, which was Sir Jackie, versus someone like the head of this brewery that wouldn't return calls because he was so important. So Sir Jackie certainly was. Prince Charles certainly was. We've got a couple of clients in this country that are really great that return calls, and we have arguments with them about.
It's good
work.
To have arguments, right?
Yeah, yeah. We say tortuous arguments. Let's torture this to death before we start investing your money in any form of communication. Let's make sure we agree together on how we do this.
Yeah, no, I think that's important. A lot of people. It's a mix of art and science.
Absolutely.
And the two usually are oil and water. But you need both components to make a good advertising campaign,
yeah.
Right?
And also, I mean, the advantage that we now have over when I was at Ogilvy's, for example, or when I was head of McCann's in the UK, is if you were dealing with an awkward client, you were terrified because actually you had staff of 300 people or more who could be affected by the decisions that you were making. Whereas since we've had our company, we've fired clients. We've actually said, we don't get on with you, the chemistry's not right, it's not working, this is what we think you should be doing.
Yeah.
You want us to do something totally different, okay? It's like yourself, Gareth, okay? You're happy doing what you're doing now,
yeah.
Okay? And in your past, you've been unhappy, okay? You're much happier now,
yeah, that's
doing
true.
What you're doing.
Yeah.
We're very happy about what we do.
So you actually tell clients, look, we'd rather not have your business.
Yes. Absolutely.
How do they respond to that? Because that's almost counterintuitive. They will think, oh, well, you want our money, so they'll do what we tell them to.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly come around and say, oh, look, we've had a look at this properly. We've done the research. Actually, we'd rather not work with you.
Yeah. The thing is that we don't want their money. Obviously, we need to live. But we don't have massive number of people that we need to pay massive salaries to constantly. So we can get rid of a client and still get by. And at the same time, we don't want to be unhappy in our work. We want to have a smile. We want to have a laugh. And we want to increase their sales. And it may sound arrogant. We do know what we're doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if we know what we're doing, why are they telling us what to do? They are not experts in communication. We are. We've picked up numerous awards for the work that we do. We're very proud of what we do.
Right.
And often what we'll end up doing is saying to a client, I'm sorry, it's our reputation. Our name is going to go on this work. If you want us to do it that way, we're not going to do it that way because that's not our way and that's our reputation. You're going to spoil our reputation.
I imagine there are a lot of very, very angry people who walk out of those meetings.
Probably us more than them, I should imagine.
Where do you think advertising's going?
I think it's getting more and more unprofessional.
Really?
Unfortunately, yeah. If you look at some friends of ours teaching some of the teaching schools here, without mentioning them, one of them would have, let's say a year ago, she had 30 pupils on her planning course. This year she's got 6.
Wow.
So people are not getting involved. The training is not as good as it used to be. Within Ogilvy's many, many years ago, you had Ogilvy's magic lanterns. There's not much of that going on now. The pressure is on from the accountants to actually sort of like run lean and mean. When I was at Ogilvy's here, we used to have, twice a year, we used to have people all over from the world to come and talk and discuss where advertising was and where it was going. I'm not sure if they do that any longer. But certainly if you look at the advertising and marketing schools, and there's some very good ones here, is they're not getting the pupils. It's not as sexy as it used to be.
Would you say this has a lot to do with just clients having all the control now, like really dictating things?
Yeah, I think it's got to do with clients dictating to you, people being afraid of making budgets. You know, with the accountants thoroughly in charge of the way that agencies operate now, the pressure on you to make money all the time is there. I'm going to use an example. The preface of my book, originally I went to Sir Martin Sorrell. Sir Martin Sorrell is the guy that owns WPP. WPP own Ogilvy's, they own JWT, they own Gray's, they own a number of agencies in this country. Mm-hmm. And I went to him, and I thought this is going to be very interesting. And I said,
what sort of a man is he? What did you know about him before you met him?
He's known as the pocket calculator.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's about 5 foot nothing, okay? And he cares about one thing, shekels.
Oh, I thought you were going to say creativity there.
No. I mean, David Ogilvy, because he had a hostile takeover of JWT, then he went after Ogilvy's, and he bought Ogilvy's, and David called him an odious little shit. Okay.
Oh, really? So they didn't like each other at all?
No. And later on, it was augmented to an odious little jerk. And in the first annual report that Sir Martin signed, once he'd taken Ogilvy's over, in the corner he'd actually written Sir Martin Sorrell brackets, odious little jerk.
Oh, really? Yeah. So he knew.
Yeah. So in answer to your question, in a roundabout way, so I wrote to Martin and I said, would you, here's my book, read through it, would you write the preface? And he wrote back a very short email. He said, Aubrey, it's a little bit difficult. And what he meant by that is the book is about the fun that we had in advertising, some of the good times and some of the bad times. And I don't think Sir Martin actually wants any of his clients to know that we do have fun. Along the way, we
what
do
kind
have
of fun. What kind of fun happened? Because I remember stories about a lot of this stuff is probably nonsense, but I've heard stories about how advertising used to be the most debaucherous, wild, mad, maniacal, insane, just bohemian business. The business was almost right at the end of that, just like that long string of adjectives. Business was kind of, we've got to make money to survive. But actually, the hedonistic lifestyle of being in advertising was the thing that attracted people.
Yeah, it's allowed you as a creative person to run.
I notice you're not rubbishing what I said, that it was all exactly like that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I look as young as I am.
Yeah.
It had to be fun, as I said right at the beginning, because you were working from 5 until maybe 5 in the morning.
Right.
And it's like the guys that built the atom bomb. The guys that built the atom bomb used to play practical jokes on each other. And we used to do that. I mean, it's very interesting because I went into Estoril's to see if they'd got my book the other day. And when I looked at the back of the book, instead of the name being Between the Briefs, they've written Between the Sheets.
Oh, no.
Which is actually quite a good Freudian slip.
It's even more. But, I mean, they really changed it there?
Yeah, yeah. So if you go into Estoril's and you ask for the book, you might have to ask for Between the Sheets or Between the Briefs.
Did they have to ask permission to do that?
No, it's just a typo. It's a mistake. It's okay. Like a, you know, probably they...
Oh, so they didn't do it on purpose?
No, not at all. Okay. But, you know, there's two stories in the book that actually do relate to, I guess, Between the Sheets.
All right.
And one is that we had a very difficult client when we were on a photographic shoot in Cannes. And it's the only time in my life. No, it's not. It's the second time. The second time was here, unfortunately, where bribery and corruption was involved. And I was asked to give a bribe to a client, and I refused to do that. And the client actually asked for us to get some women for him, which I refused to do. And he pestered us and pestered us and pestered us. So eventually I went to a store, and in my broken French, said I would like to buy the most expensive inflatable doll they had. And so we went and we bought this inflatable doll and then pumped it up and put it in his bed. and then took out all the light bulbs. So when you went into the room, you could just see this big pair of red lips poking out from between the sheets. So that's why between the sheets, this Freudian slip was quite good.
I see.
We then took him down to the bar and got him a little bit pissed. And he wandered up to the room with a bottle of champagne and two glasses, because we told him we got a woman for him.
Yeah.
He opened the door, and then there was, Mon Dieu! And someone's been murdered in my bed, and we heard this bottle of champagne break open, and the cork fire, and he soaked himself in champagne, and so forth, you know. That was a real between-the-sheets story. The other one was, I think you call it upon the kitchen table.
Oh, yeah?
Is that away from us in one of the agencies in London I worked on, is that one of my partners used to go over on a Tuesday and a Thursday and get on the kitchen table with his girlfriend, and we used to watch through binoculars. And then you got to find out about that. So that, you know, those are a couple of the stories. There's the kidnapping in Cannes and so forth. There are some funny stories along the way.
What is Cannes like, and what was it like during those hedonistic years? It must have been, because then you've got advertisers from all over the world coming together, and they're there to celebrate.
Yeah.
So there's every reason to misbehave. I mean, parties on yachts and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, there's some amazing parties that you actually have there. First of all, there's a very dangerous drink that should be avoided, which is Pernod and champagne. That's the drink of Cannes.
Okay? Oh, really?
So that's sort of
when,
like,
you put a little bit of Pernod at the bottom and you pour champagne over the
top. Yeah, so it's
sort of licorice-y champagne.
It's very refreshing, and that's why it's dangerous. Yeah, because if you're out in the sun, you know, this is a lovely drink, until you find yourself on the floor. You know,
okay.
So Cannes is very, very sparkling, you know, in more ways than one, all the champagne. The things that go on there, I mean, there's a story. I was told this story. There was one of the film directors there, a very famous film director, went along to a store, and he bought up all the inflatable penguins that he could find, like 300 of them. And then he had his assistant blow up these inflatable penguins and fill the pool of the five-star hotel. So there was no room in the morning for anybody to actually swim in at all. There were just these inflatable penguins bobbing up and down. So that was one of the things that he got up to.
Sounds like a hell of a life. I think it's a terrific read. Between the Briefs is what it's called. Aubrey Mauldin, thank you so much for coming to speak to us this morning. That's only really the tip of the iceberg in your book. There's so much more. CliffCentral.com